All right, do that again because we're recording.
I'm ready. Okay. This is Live from the Table, the bonus episode. Coming at you on the Riotcast Podcast Network. I'm Dan Natterman. We got Perry L. Ashenbrand with us tonight, as always, and Dev Davidoff. We're actually moving to an all-classic rock format on the podcast, and we're going to start things off with Chicago, If You Leave Me Now, from 1977, and featured here was in rare form.
That's good stuff.
Of course, I'm kidding. We are not switching to an all-classic rock format, although I would very much like to.
All-classic rock podcast. That's great.
I'm not sure that that song is even classic rock necessarily, but we have 88 degrees here in New York City, partly cloudy skies, and traffic and weather coming at you on the ones. Anyway, I'm just ready.
What are the call signs for Comedy Club Podcast?
It's amazing. You have an amazing, he has an amazing voice for this.
I agree. It's
fairly basic. You just give the weather, you talk about the BQE a little bit, and you got a radio show.
Say something about the BQE.
As an accident on the BQE, we got traffic backed up all the way to the Bruckner. We'll be slow moving rush hour. Traffic will be normal on the Major Deegan and
Major Deegan.
Side crossings.
Yep.
Anyhow, so
it's good stuff.
We are
hot.
Still in lockdown, and the summer is coming to a close, so one wonders what things are going to be like.
Ariel, you're in a new room with a lot of light.
That's so funny. That's what Dan just said. I am in a new room. I moved.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I mean, also to a temporary...
Okay.
Temporarily seeking shelter.
Yeah.
From the pandemic.
Yeah, sure. Do you have any idea of how long you're going to be in your present spot?
I mean, until there's
no further guidance from the city and all of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean until there's a comedy world, until there's school,
yeah.
Until there's, you know,
yeah.
Until I can
yeah.
function.
Yeah. Are your kids going back to school in September or late August?
My kid is doing remote learning.
Yeah.
From all of my friends and the people I'm speaking to, it seems like 50-50. 50% of them are sending their kids. Although I just read something that a private school in the West Village opened, and now they had to close down for 2 weeks because two people tested positive.
Yeah. Would you feel comfortable sending your kids even if that were a reasonable option?
It is an option. We could choose for his school, and I'm not sending him.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
I don't think they're going to be open very long anyway.
Yeah.
Like, I think
I was talking to somebody I know in Sweden. You can read this anywhere, but their schools are open and they've been open. Their bars and restaurants have been open. They're not wearing masks. And the only thing that's closed are theaters, movie theaters and theaters in general. And
do we know what the outcome of the herd immunity program in Sweden has been? Are there that many more people that have
gotten have a higher death per capita death toll than a lot
is
of
is it that much higher?
I don't know if it's that much higher, and it's lower than other countries. It's higher than some, it's lower than others.
Well, if it's lower than some and higher than others, and it puts it in some relatively moderate range relative to other countries, then wouldn't you be better off? I mean, if that's the...
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, what are we waiting for? Are we waiting for a vaccine? And tell us we're waiting for a vaccine. It's like, it seems unclear to me what we're waiting for. They're not really telling us. What exactly are we waiting for? Are we waiting for a vaccine? Because if there's no vaccine, there's going to be an increase in cases when you send kids to school, you know.
Right.
The kids probably won't have a severe case, and they'll probably... recover just fine, but they're going to get it, some of them. So I don't know what we're waiting on. By the way, I want to talk a bit about...
I'm looking at this. I can send it to both of you and you can screen share it. But I'm looking at the numbers in Sweden right now. And they seem to be on like this.
They're going up? On its way up.
Cases are up. Hang on. I'm going to send it to you guys.
Well, we don't need to... I don't know how to screen share anyway. That's more of Noam's expertise. He loves to screen share. No, and of course, we don't know what the deaths are.
Right. I mean, and also we don't know what the outcome is economically in this country as it relates to unemployment, suicide, depression. All of the externalities of, you know, closing up. And so it'll be fascinating, you know, in a year or two from now to look back and see whether or not Sweden fares any better than other countries who did shut down. But I guess that's neither here nor there, since we don't really know. I just didn't know if Sweden was a calamitous situation right now, or if they seem to be operating not much worse than other countries who did shut down.
And they are social distancing. I mean, people are more likely to stay home in Sweden, but it's all voluntary. You can go to a restaurant, you can go to a store, and the kids are going to school.
Yeah, I don't see with America's, you know, I just ordered this book and they're talking about how, you know, the notion of American individualism as it relates to like countries where people listen. We aren't that well. Our culture is less organizationally. Our culture doesn't lend itself towards everybody following the rules. Right. And so we see what's going on mask-wise. I mean, the other offshoot of that in terms of productivity is like, you know, product innovation and things like that. Americans are very good at, but we can't seem to make it happen in a group sense. Although I definitely haven't had tremendous guidance from government.
I definitely think we're more individualistic. I don't think we have much sense of we're all in this together. I think that's one of the reasons universal health care is not really is a controversial idea here, because we don't really believe in helping each other. We don't feel united.
We need an Asian discipline. An Asian discipline is what we need.
I think to have Asian discipline, you need Asian people.
Yes, that's the problem.
It would certainly be a good start anyway. Yeah. And we don't have enough of those.
Well, you know, the Germans are the Asians of Europe, and they seem to be doing that. They seem to be capable of all marching in lockstep, for better and for worse, of course. We understand that certain historical drawbacks to everybody listening to one guy, but...
I don't understand how wearing a mask becomes my freedom is being infringed upon.
Yeah, no sense.
Americans are a funny crew, aren't they? You know, they.
Do you think that this would have been the case, Periel, if we weren't already divided? Like, do you think that the notion that a lot of people politicize wearing a mask is cumulatively worse because we were so divided when it all began?
Probably.
Yeah, I think so.
Probably. It's idiotic, though. It's like you wear a seatbelt, right? Like you wear fucking shoes.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Right.
I think, Doug, that's true. I think that, you know, people are just looking at reasons to pick a fight. You know, when you don't get along with somebody, anything they say is annoying to you, and you want to snap back.
Yeah.
And the seatbelt, you know, I mean, it's almost a good premise for a joke, but the notion of a seatbelt has not become politicized. We all agree that you're more likely to survive a car accident with a seatbelt. And if that's the case with masks, if nobody's politicizing seatbelts and it becoming a cause celeb for, you know, clawing freedoms from people, then why would you suddenly politicize in a major way the notion that a mask is probably helpful?
Part of it is that, you know, you can't see the COVID virus, and it's a little bit, and the truth is, I sent you something from the CDC, Periel, this week, where the CDC says masks might be helpful. Even the CDC doesn't go as far as to say masks are definitely helpful. The CDC said masks might be helpful.
Well, but isn't that the same? The same
seatbelt. Everybody. No, nobody's saying a seatbelt might help you. Everybody's.
Well, but yeah. But although that is true as well, right? I mean, as a premise. So, I mean, there are people that were thrown from cars who ended up being okay because they weren't wearing their seatbelt, though they are the exception. But you can make an argument that in theory you could be safer without a seatbelt. Just statistically, you're not. I don't know.
Well, maybe.
I'm trying to find something.
Yeah, I mean, if the seatbelt laws were new and they were brought up by Democrats, maybe would be a backlash today because everybody's looking to pick a fight. So I don't know. Speaking of picking a fight, I want to talk about James Altucher's article. He was on the show with us, with me and Noam. And I don't know if you know that Seinfeld responded. James Altucher, just to review, he's part owner of Stand Up New York Comedy Club, wrote an article called New York is Dead and It's Not Coming Back or something like that.
New York City is Dead Forever.
Okay, New York City is Dead Forever. Whatever was the name, that's the theme of the article, is that this pandemic is going to basically destroy New York City in part because people are getting used to working at home and they're getting used to remote work. And so
Meaning, because of what he was saying?
Because of what he was saying, and he was basically lambasting James for having left the city and gone to Florida and said, basically, stay in Florida. We don't need you. We're going to continue without you. The city's going to be great.
Right.
And Zoom cannot possibly take the place of human contact.
Right.
So, so in addition to making what I thought were some valid points, he took a few shots at James, and he also said that Stand Up New York could use some sprucing up as a club.
Right. Well, there's no arguing, although I haven't been there in a while, but you know, most comedy clubs, I mean, if you're trying to make an argument, they could use a light sprucing up. It's not a tough argument to make.
Yeah. The only comedy club that really was on point aesthetically was Comics, which closed down about 8 years ago.
Yeah. And never caught on in the first place, seemingly. Yeah. With all of its glory. I mean, really was a beautiful club.
It was a beautiful club, but were you ever at Comics?
No, I was not at Comics, but
Comics was a beautiful club. They put a lot of money into it.
Yeah.
And the owners would tell us, they would come, I remember the owners saying, we spared no expense, we put money to the club, we're gonna have good food, we're gonna treat the comics right. And we're nodding our heads thinking, we don't wanna tell them the truth. Which is that this is not a recipe for success. The comedy business, we're like, oh, sounds great. Because the comedy business is not about that. It's about keeping expenses low. And nobody's paying a premium for a nice, beautiful room. You know, it's a hole in the wall by nature.
Why?
I think it's the informal nature of the art form. You know, it's a little dirty, it's a little gritty.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a big, beautiful room that, you know, and if you're paying all that money
The only other comparison I can think of would be a room like a Caroline's or something, right? I mean, there aren't too many clubs that were in anywhere in the country that were as polished as Comics. But, you know, the other thing about it, Perry, it was in a meatpacking district in an area where it was sort of catty-corner to where the Apple store is now. And it was a pretty, you know, sort of she. It just didn't fit. It's a funny thing about what makes a business work or not work. It just didn't,
Well,
there is something low-life about comedy.
There's something what about comedy?
No, there's something about comedy that it should be done in a basement at night. You're doing there's something, you're offending something because there are other art forms you could go in an opera, you know, chandeliers and a thing. You walk in a room with a chandelier, you go, you do comedy?
Comedy is sort of just meant as it's like an underground kind of a thing by nature, you know.
The specials are taped in these sort of beautiful rooms, which is interesting.
That's true. But specials are, it's a different experience watching something on television. So a big black theater doesn't distance you from the ability to appreciate it. For some reason, I don't know why, but comedy does feel like it should be done in a speakeasy. Like somebody where they used to make bathtub gin, you know, and then they put a mic on it. Something Yeah.
And also, you got to keep expenses down, you know, and you're not gaining anything by paying more money for rent and more money for fit out.
Yeah.
So if you're not gaining anything, you're losing because your expenses are high. You know?
So it's really just about the vibe of the room.
Vibe is incredibly important in comedy. And I think more than a lot of, I think the success of a comedy business would be more contingent and connected to the vibe variable than most businesses. I don't know why, but
And also the Meatpacking District, like you said, was kind of a cool neighborhood club where people went clubbing.
Yeah, it's like you're going to Pastis, or you're going around the corner to a nightclub where they have bottle service. Like, comedy is a grittier sort of, you know, I don't know. We don't have to search for too many adjectives.
Wait, I want to tell you something, though. So Stand Up New York responded via Instagram. They said, Jerry, we're able to multitask. We are sprucing up the club. See, we just stained our tables. We're also currently the biggest live comedy producer in the country. 40-plus shows per week in parks across New York City. You should swing by and do a set sometime. Oh, we just walked by your garage on the Upper West Side where you house your Porsche collection and picked up some garbage we found in front of it. Heard you were in the Hamptons. See you at the club.
Well, you know.
That's pretty good.
I would have preferred they said, nobody cares what you have to say. And, you know, I don't know if you heard, but Seinfeld ended 20 years ago. Shut up.
Shut up. Shut your mouth.
Which would have been more satisfying, but anyway.
But did you think, I read Jerry's piece in the Times. But I thought it was nice to hear someone defending New York. The human nature is that the notion of that pendulum, right? It seems like an inescapable response to that which is negative or positive. Any kind of black swan, major earth-shattering experience, whether it's 9/11. 9/11, I don't know if the banking crisis would fit there, but even when that guy lit his shoe on fire on the airplane, the shoe bomb never went off, and no one since has been able, nobody before or since, there's been one person in the history of the world who tried to light a shoe bomb, and now everybody all over the fucking world has got to take their shoe off when they walk through security. I think it's just connected to the notion that New York will be back. You know, I mean, Paris went through the plague, for God's sake. I remember walking through, were you there, Dan, in Paris? Did you go in the tombs where they have all the bones stacked on one another?
I didn't check out the tomb.
Incredible. But hey, you know, half the city it was dying of the plague. It came back, baby.
James's basic point, I think the cornerstone of his argument was that that there is a major change is that people are used to and able to work from home. And Seinfeld's point was that working from home is no substitute for being together, for the dynamism and the energy of being in the presence of each other.
Yes.
I think that's valid. I think we've talked about this, Dove. There will be a change.
Yes.
There will be, commercial real estate will be affected. There will be less office.
Well, you're 100% right.
But it's not over for
it's folks. It's not over. And here's what's at least my thesis. And I bet on my thesis. I'm not just talking from an armchair. I've dumped some money into a commercial REIT. On the point being, human nature is such that people will go back to malls. Not everywhere. A lot of them will go out of business, a lot of individual places, but we will still gather in central entertainment zones. Office buildings will be repriced. They're not going to be, maybe you know, maybe there are more creative elements that will come to New York that otherwise couldn't have afforded to do so. And I don't know. I mean, that's the history of New York in the Village and in Soho and the
thing. Of course.
But what I'm surprised at is how personally everybody seemed to take it. There's one thing to disagree with James. James said, okay, I think New York is dying and it's going to stay dead.
Right.
It's one thing to say, actually, I disagree, and here's why. It's another thing to be like, you're a putz, fuck you.
Right.
Piece of shit.
Yeah.
Shit. You know, why is everybody taking it personally? Nobody takes it personally when we say that climate change is going to devastate the planet. We say, yes, it is if we don't act, or some people don't think it's the case. Generally speaking, when people predict catastrophe, people predict another 4 years of Trump.
Yeah.
And we're facing existential crisis, say many people. That is, the very existence of America is in jeopardy.
Right.
That's a dire prediction. But I don't get angry at those people. I simply say, actually, I don't think so. Here's why.
Right.
Why the fury and this kind of...
You know why I think Seinfeld...
I'm a real New Yorker, and fuck you, and New York, and we're not going to fuck you, and it's New York. You know, why that reaction?
Well, I think science...
Why not just very calm? Actually, I think that Zoom will not replace offices, and there's still reasons to live in it. Why that kind of response?
Yeah, no, that would seem like the more appropriate calm, sort of just deconstruct the argument or make your own argument. But it's like, I think people are very emotional right now, for one. And then for two, there is a bit of this kind of, you know, if you're going to walk out and give up on it, then fuck you vibe. Or you know... Because it's in a, I don't know, when something's in a difficult place, then the notion of rallying around that which has been wounded is that much more important. And that's an emotional experience. And so New York City is not, you're not just examining or underwriting a company as a function of whether or not you're going to buy a stock. It's alive in that sense. It's like you're watching something go down, and you can stay and support it and fight for it on some level, I guess. I think that's what
we want some glimmers of hope right now, I think.
We
need to see, you know, we're going to get through this. It's going to be...
But he's not saying that that the world is doomed. He's saying New York is doomed. So in aggregate, I don't agree. And I said to him why on a previous podcast. But look, things change. You know, cities rise, they fall. New York will die someday.
The sun will fall up someday.
Pardon?
I say the sun is going to fall up someday.
So the question is, and things might change. New York might not all. I mean, Philadelphia was once the biggest city in America. It's not anymore. New York may decline at some point.
Yeah.
You know, that's how things work. I don't think it's imminent, but I don't think anything to take personally either.
Right, but also the notion that, you know, even if some of the economic dynamism dies down in urban centers by way of
we're losing love.
Maybe different types of, you know, what's that?
No, your sound was bad for a second, yeah. So you're saying urban dynamism.
Well, yeah, no, the notion of all of that, all of these economic drivers, you know, it's that kind of calamity that brings about change is not necessarily a long-term net negative for a city. I mean, things consolidate and then they expand depending on what the underlying forces at play are. I mean, I remember going to Soho when I was a kid and it was just a warehouse district. And then there was like Warhol. I mean, you know, he was there before my time. But when you heard about these people, and then Soho became sort of an interesting artsy place where people didn't need a ton of dough and could live in lofts in a relatively dangerous area that was vacant at night. And it's since turned into this relatively corporate kind of flagship stores. It's you know, I don't know. Maybe New York gets repriced. I mean, it's going to ding me as a landlord, but aside from the profit perspective, there are aspects that could become more dynamic or attractive. I don't know.
I think for creative people, especially comedians, I mean, New York is the heart and soul in so many ways of what we do. And so the thought that it's dead forever is devastating.
Yeah, I mean, I'm
I think that's why people are reacting that way.
It would be, but it seems to me, because I so do not believe it,
right.
I was not upset by it.
Right.
You know, generally speaking, you don't get upset by things unless you think there's some, grain of truth in it. He said,
listen, everybody that ran to the suburbs to escape this COVID, there's going to be a vaccine at some point. It's not going to be 100% effective, but it'll be effective enough to get people get back to mitigate a lot of fear and anxiety. They're going to get so bored in the suburbs. Listen, believe me, at some point that they'll be back sniffing around the city. You know, again, things get repriced. Come on, how long? I mean, look, if you have kids, that's a different story. If you have kids,
I think that, you know, I'm desperate to get back into the city.
Well, you are. No, you are. I was just thinking of people with children that you know, have corporate jobs and then can work from home and weren't in love with New York to begin with. They were there because their salary was there and they couldn't commute for 2 hours a day. I think those people will stay in Connecticut and Rochester. But I think that will leave room for other people to come in that want to be in New York
for
New York. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean,
I think the other thing was that Jerry was giving James like, oh, well, you're in Florida. And then it was like, right. Yeah, well, you're in the fucking Hamptons. So what are you, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Jerry was a little bit harsh, I thought. And especially because he is this billionaire, you know, one should be a little bit, you know, he's the man with all the power. And it's being a little bit of a bully, I think.
Yeah.
Somebody who's far less lower on the totem pole.
Right.
And to call him a putz in a major publication and basically, you know, tell him to go to Florida. And he insulted Florida too.
Yeah.
Which doesn't bother me necessarily. But but basically said Florida was, you know, I mean, I forgot how he phrased it, but, you know, it was a creative dead zone basically. And, you know, a fitting punishment for James to have to be there for you know, a long time to come. Again, taking James' words very personally. You don't agree with them, you don't agree with them, you know?
Although they do say that...
The Mayans said we're all going to be dead, you know, by the end of the year, but nobody's blowing up against the Mayans and saying, you putzes.
Right.
One could argue that... Well,
people predict doom sometimes, you know. I don't think it's a reason to snap at them. Now, if you don't like James for other reasons, okay, well, then talk about that. Maybe you don't think his club is... And he could use some sprucing up. Okay, fine, you know. You don't like his hair. I get it. He probably could use a haircut, sure. I got mine cut, as you can see.
Yeah, yeah. Dan looks good. Perriel, you see Dan's hair? He looks good with a haircut. That's why I harass him, so that he stays. He looks good with it.
He does look good with it, but I also like that long, shaggy.
Some people like it, you know. Now, we were in lockdown, Dove, so that, you know, for at least for the first couple of months, I wasn't able to get a haircut.
That's right. No, on full lockdown, yes.
We're on full lockdown. Now, laundromats were open, so I have no excuse for my underwear. But, that was a joke I used to tell during Zoom shows earlier in the pandemic. You know, it always did okay. It never annihilated.
But. Are these, by the way, are these outdoor shows picking up steam? Are they becoming?
Yeah, I just did one in the park, in Central Park, in Sheep Meadow. I think they call it that because I believe sheep used to graze there. Well, the sheep are gone now. But comedy is so taking its place, and it's by a big oak tree, you know, near Tavern on the Green on the west side of Sheep Meadow, and. Yeah, just people sitting on the grass in a semicircle, and
How many people can, because you're not amplified, right?
So yeah, well, no, actually, the last time I did it, there was a mic with a little handheld speaker. Very, very obviously not particularly powerful.
Yeah.
It helped a little bit. Maybe like 40.
Like the situation we saw the rabbi in the park?
Yeah, maybe like the rabbi guy. So it helped a bit, and maybe 40 people, and they were enjoying it. They really were. Yeah. I feel a little self-conscious because there's other people that aren't there for the show.
Yeah.
And when people aren't there for a show and they're kind of sitting in proximity, I feel like an idiot.
It's very distracting. It happens, that same experience, that same feeling happens, like if you work in a club that's it's not, you ever work a club that was really supposed to be like a retail strip and there's a window in front. And so they try to block the window, but every now and then you could see people peering in, you know,
sometimes you do a corporate gig. So corporate gigs are often like when you perform for a company's annual, whatever, they're in a hotel. They're in like the Chesapeake room, or, you know, the wind jammer room, whatever they call it.
Yes.
So you're in these rooms and it's people are opening the door and hotel guests are just walking by and they can hear you and, you know, doing your shtick. And it's just, I just feel self-conscious doing my
And it's even worse if the gig's not going well, because then it's that much more pronounced than those corporate humps. You know, they don't understand that in comedy, a lot of it's, you know, the psychological, the need to be in proximity to one another in order to appreciate it. I did a corporate, I mean, you've done a lot more than me, but they put 30 people in a room that seats, you know, 700, and it's a horrible feeling. There's something about all that space. You feel swallowed up by it. I'd rather work for 10,000 people. It's far less anxiety. Anyway.
Yeah, well, the corporate gigs, you know, it's for the money. They pay well, and you
are.
No,
but they don't understand it. And people that are interested in comedy, it's an interesting consideration psychologically, because what is it about, you know, it's the contagious nature of laughter that is served by ergonomics and proximity. Yeah. And if you don't have that, the whole experience becomes swallowed up, you know. It really impacts it. I mean, it's profound, the impact.
You have to start saying, like, you can't have a room, like, you have to have rooms that are to capacity. You can't book for a corporate gig in a 700 person.
You don't always have an option. And so you can't really, when they're paying you to come to a gig, they're just like, you know, you get an agent that says, if you said to your agent, you know, look, can you make sure that they're in a room that,
you can do the best you can, but you had to accept the fact. You do the best you can, but you had to accept the fact that they're not running a comedy club, and they don't do this every day, so they don't really know how to make it.
They don't know.
And they don't necessarily care. You know. Then, so, you know, if the show doesn't go great, okay, then they have the golf tournament the next day. I mean, they have different activities. Okay, well, you know, we'll also have a singer. We booked a singer too. So the comedy show doesn't go well, hopefully they'll enjoy the singer
or the hypnotist. It is such an intensely, that experience, I wonder if there are any other lines of work where people experience, you know, that level of when something is going badly in like a corporate scenario. That gig I did in the Seychelles for that Arab, that gig. Did I tell you, Periel? I went to the Seychelles, about 900 miles off the coast of Somalia.
Yeah, it's far away.
Off of Africa. And so, they flew us out for one show. And I got to the resort. I get in the room. It's these a couple of very wealthy Arab guys. And then about 19 hookers. And then like five homosexuals that sort of tend to the prostitutes. And so, and English was, none of them, I don't think most of the people didn't have English as their first language. So you've got, well, they were escorts, you know, I don't want to say hooker, but they were professional. They were so professional. You know, they were very professional women. These are professionals, you understand. It's not your garden variety hoe. And they flew all the women in from South Africa.
Okay, can you backtrack here for a second?
Yeah,
First of all, who was in charge here? There was one guy who was like, I have money to burn, and I've got six hookers, and I want Dove.
Oh, no, nobody says hooker, nobody says, but it's just sort of understood that this is a private affair, and they have this, they build this room at a resort, and it's a performance space, and they fly these people in, and they don't stay and mix with everybody in the resort. They have their own piece of it. It's the guy flies himself in a helicopter. You know, it's like it was a real James Bond kind of thing. It
and
was full on James
there?
Bond.
Were you in a private plane?
Oh no, I wasn't. No. He was a billionaire, but not like an American billionaire that, you know, you're still an American person. I would imagine if you grow up in Saudi Arabia and you're of that ilk, entertainment for you is like, it's like, you know, when somebody brings a camel in the room and the camel does some tricks and then they bring the camel out of the room. In America, you're like, you're a bit of a little mini star in the room and people want to talk to you if you were funny. And here he's like, you know, okay, good boy, nice. And then they just sort of move you along. He didn't care how funny you were, or what you did. He's unimpressed by television. Nobody that flies themselves in on a chopper and hangs out with 19 hookers is impressed by showbiz people. You know, they run things, these people. And so he knew how to behave. This is a real man, you understand.
How did you get this gig?
This guy watched the whole show with his own bottle service in a room that he built with only 25 people in a room that seats 300. I mean, it was absurd.
He said, how did you get it? Your manager called or your agent called?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, an agent. Yeah.
Wait, specifically you, I'm imagining.
Well, I don't know who chose me. These people on islands, you know, it was like a villain from a James Bond movie. They have a Dutch handler. And so I don't interface with the guy who owns the operation much. There was a good-looking Dutchman on a motorcycle, and he would organize the affair, you know. And then
how much time did you do? Like, are you up there?
About 25 minutes. And it was fine. They were polite people, but challenging, and sort of, you could tell, like, the women that were there, it was like, you could just feel that they were sort of hired to be there. It was fucking bananas.
You would think a guy like that might send one to your room after, you know.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking maybe the guy goes, hey, I thought you were really funny. You know, I'm not with all these broads. You know, you come back, stage with us, have a drink. He sent me out of there like a dancing camel. I did my dance, and the people were all right, and then moving on. And then he entertainment to him, you could just see it. It was like a 500-year-old, you know, a Bedouin leader in a tent like the king, and, you know, chop chop, and then he's eating. He's, you know, the guy's got a gold, and he's got his chest open, and he's eating. He's come in, entertain, good boy, moving on. Nothing. He gave me nothing, this guy. And he liked me, and he treated me like a dog. Treated me like a dog, and was a fan. You can only imagine if this guy didn't like the entertainment. Yeah, no, listen.
That's a long-ass flight.
19. Yeah, for 25 minutes of work, it was you go all the way to the Seychelles.
The Seychelles is like in the middle of fucking nowhere. I mean, it's like a 24-hour flight, isn't it?
It takes in the neighborhood of 20 hours to get there.
In the Indian Ocean, I believe.
Yeah, it's.
I believe it's the Indian Ocean. I think it's the oldest, island chain in the world. Does that make sense in terms of age?
I mean, geologically. I mean, I
geologically, guess yeah. I mean, it's Yeah, it's a fascinating place that nobody ever brings up. I thought the Seychelles, I didn't know what it was. I thought it was like,
not a lot of new islands, you know. You hear about that new island?
Well, no, yeah, no. I realize that when I said it, oldest island. How do you determine that? But I believe.
But maybe it's like 2 billion years old, and the other islands are a billion. I mean, I don't know. But anyway, Perry, what were some of the other topics I had sent you for this week? I don't know if you wanted to talk a bit about Jeff Ross.
Oh, no.
Dove, what's your sense? Do you want to broach that?
Well, you know, I mean, I try to stay out of the Twitter sphere for now in my life. I you know, my mother suggested that I may need meds because I don't know. I mean, it was a, you know, offhanded suggestion in terms of just being generally easily aggravated by things, you know, and then, and, you know, so the Jeff Ross, that I've been trying to stay away from all of the stuff, the stimuli. Mm-hmm. I don't know with Ross. And it was one person, right? And so.
Well, just to summarize.
Yeah, refresh the audience, because maybe not everybody knows.
Jeff Ross is a comic. You may know him. He's the Roastmaster General.
Yeah, Roastmaster.
He's accused, has been accused.
He runs the post office and as well, and he roasts comedically as well. He's
has
the Roastmaster.
Been accused by a woman who's now in her 30s. Of, she said that they had sex when he was 33 and she was 15, which is, needless to say, below the legal age of consent everywhere in America. So that is her accusation. It is an accusation that, you know, she has no direct evidence for it, but she has a lot of circumstantial evidence for it. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, but now, what is the consideration is whether or not he deserves to be canceled?
The consideration, I guess, is, I mean, as is the case every time this comes up, because it comes up.
Yeah.
You know, it came up with several other people. You have a guy accused of something. We're not in a court of law, but people are entitled to make their own decisions. But, you know, you get this Twitter momentum going and calls for cancellation, if you will. Calls for
she, what was the tenor of the affair? Was she, did she feel violated? Is she talking about, like,
okay,
what was her?
Just to summarize.
Yeah.
She went after him by her own account.
Okay.
At that time, she was very, very attracted to him, and she came on.
Well, stop right there. We need to explain that variable. We need science, and we got to explain anyway. But
very unusual.
Yeah, I mean, this is
Well, let me finish my summary, Perio.
Okay.
So she came on to him. He said, "Are you sure?" She said, "Yes." They had an affair. It went on. This is according to her, for several years, from the time she was 15, off and on, till I think she was in her early 20s.
Wow.
And then at some point in later years, she decided that she wanted to that she was manipulated, mistreated, and that Jeff needs to be punished. So. She went online, and at first nobody really was listening to her, but the story eventually made it to an article in vulture.com, and it became a big story, and so here we are.
Did she give an example of the types of manipulation that went on, or that she perceived as having gone on?
Well, no, but legally it's you know, you don't need to.
Well,
I mean, legally,
I understand
criminal behavior.
Well, she says that her father encouraged her to...
Yes, by all accounts, the father was okay with it.
More than okay. I mean, I'm not saying...
The question is nobody can, assuming the accusations are true, nobody can say that it was a criminal act. The question is what exactly is the minute you, and I tried on Twitter to have conversations with people about, okay, you can't do it. The minute you say, well, let's examine, not to say that he didn't do wrong, he did do wrong.
There's no nuance.
But let's try to ascertain the degree of immorality so that we can.
There is a big difference.
Nobody wants to even have a discussion. Nobody wants to have that discussion. Oh, you're defending a rapist. No, I didn't say that. I said that there's degrees of immorality, and let's try to determine where this fits in.
The age of consent in Nigeria is 11.
Unfortunately, Jeff has not been active in that part of the world, and so he's been forced to meet his people here. And so now we have to deal with these Western, these pesky Western.
Neil Brennan got called out. Neil Brennan on his podcast said, well, they had a relationship. So he felt that that was mitigating. In other words, it wasn't.
Well, it is mitigating relative to raping somebody in an alley. I mean, there are great gradations of offense. So nobody can argue that, you know, that there's impropriety, but you must ascertain the degree of said impropriety if you're going to levy a goddamn judgment or at least a punishment. You can judge all you want, but we got to get clear on some of this, because there's a massive difference between the relationship between Woody Allen and Mia Farrow and not Mia Farrow, Dan, you know, in Manhattan.
He was seen Mariel Hemingway,
yeah. And so there's that relationship where you don't feel as though he was really in violation. I understand. I mean, she was 17 in the film. But assuming she were 2 years younger, yes, if I were her father, I'd want to, you know, you'd want to put somebody in prison or kill her, you know. But yes, not all violations are equal. And so there needs to be some nuance in the discussion. You didn't argue that it's not necessarily wrong, because inevitably there can be some form of manipulation when you're dealing with a 15-year-old. But, you know.
Right. And to even bring that up, even have a discussion, where you might be wrong. Maybe Neil's wrong. Maybe Neil was wrong when he said it's okay. And the fact that they were in a relationship makes it better.
We're doing the same thing around race.
When Neil said that, Twitter went to work and said Neil's defending pedophilia.
Right.
You know, at least some people. I don't know how many people said it, but some people said it. And I chimed in to defend Neil, and then I was taken to task by.
You can't have an intellectually dynamic, curious experience in a public setting. You can't question how are we, I guess as a group, supposed to conduct inquiry and create opinions that are informed if all we are allowed to do is communicate with other people in our echo chamber, otherwise we'll be punished for any thought we have outside of whatever.
But Twitter is not the forum in which to do that. I think that by design, Twitter is the forum in which people feel comfortable sort of shine by just attacking and, you know, virtue signaling and then disappearing into the world of, you know, the ether.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, speaking of discussion, is what goes on in the state. And I've had we've discussed this, what goes on in the state Senate when somebody has to make this law. Somebody had to decide that 15, that 17 was okay, and 16, you're a pedophile.
Right.
Somebody had to make that decision. So I've always wondered at it about what goes on in the legislature if a state representative stands up and says, now, I understand that. I understand that the young lady, 15, is certainly a young lady, no question about it. but my constituents feel that she is that nature has endowed her with the.
But that's absolutely right. I mean, Dan's making it funny, but some of these lines seem arbitrary, though this one is not. Okay. The notion of a 15-year-old being ill-prepared to deal with somebody 15 years her senior is inarguable. And we don't live in an agrarian society where the priority of having
With all due respect to the gentleman from the Lower East Side, I feel as though 13 would be an appropriate minimum age that my constituents, who are rural folk, you understand, and they get lonely. Not a lot of women folk around, especially during harvesting season. And
that's right, during harvesting season.
First of all, part of the problem is that the people in charge actually do sound like that.
Yes, you're right.
The ones in North Carolina, maybe.
Those aren't the people who should be making those laws.
No, every state has to make a law. Every state has to come up with a number.
Well, everything's in the ballpark, though. Like, it's between 16 and 17, in this country, anyway.
Right.
And to be very clear, this is not, pedophilia is prepubescent children. This is not what we're talking about.
But I wouldn't dare say that on Twitter.
Well, I mean, it's the definition
I know it's the definition, but people don't want to hear that either. They want to just say.
That's how charged it all becomes. You're not allowed to say the definition, for God. I mean, it's wild out there.
I mean, you actually have a few really funny jokes about like the actual definition of a fucking word, right?
I do.
You do.
Yeah. No, it's in there somewhere, but it's like.
The dove or me with the definition jokes?
Either way.
Dove.
Either way. I mean, the notion of, I don't know,
Look, I don't think 15-year-olds should be fucking 30-year-olds, or 30-year-olds should be fucking 15-year-olds. And what do you think is going to happen when you have, like, obviously that's a disaster. Right.
Look, there's no argument that it's ill-conceived or against that being the case. I think the only thing that we want to be able to engage about, whether it's race or Me Too related or underage, is a discussion about the same, literally, precisely the same model our legal system uses to determine the degree to which you need to be punished.
Also, I think it was 30 and 15, not 33.
33. It was 30. In the case of Jeff, the accusation is 33.
I mean, when my girlfriends and I were 15 years old, one of my girlfriends had sex with a 26-year-old guy, and years later, when she was 15, and she wound up marrying him. I mean, they got divorced later, many years later. But, Courtney Stodden married that guy, that actor. You guys know who he is?
I don't know who Courtney Stodden is. Let alone the actor that she married.
I'm sure it's an example of somebody with a major age gap, regardless. But it's like
Courtney Alexis Stodden. She's a American media person. But we have to draw a line somewhere. But we can't let everybody have sex with anybody they want. So I think a 17 is 18 is a reasonable line. So, but the question is what is the degree of immorality and therefore what's the degree of punishment? Because there are people that would see Jeff go to jail. There are people for whom 10 years in state prison for Jeff would be appropriate. I don't think that would be appropriate. I think that would be excessive.
Although I think it's reasonable, and even she says here, please don't ever do this to another minor again, even if the parents sign off. She was groomed as a child bride and verbally abused by Doug Hutchinson. No 15-year-old is equipped mentally to be in a relationship with a 30-something-year-old person. Right?
Well, you're 100% right, but I don't think there's any reasonable argument there. It's not even an argument. It's only my desire would be to enter into a discussion about what went to understand the context of what went on, the degree of offense.
Right.
And it's only upon that level of consideration that we would be able to determine whether or not the punishment fits the crime. I mean, this is literally 300-year-old legal theory. I mean,
She says.
Why are we not following our own?
My understanding is that she is very forthcoming and that she pursued him. I mean, she actively pursued him.
Right.
And with Dave and other adults, including her own father, enabled that behavior and supported that behavior.
To what extent you want to say that that's a mitigating circumstance is up for discussion, but But others, certainly people would say that does not mitigate it at all. And were I even to say that might be mitigating, I would be taken to task for that by certain people. So
what did they say to you?
They just said, defending pedophilia.
Right.
Just because, and I was simply defending Neil's discussion of the
if you took a snapshot of the definition of the word pedophilia from the dictionary and posted it, do you think you would also get similar?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. If I did it with the in order to imply that it's not pedophilia to have sex with a 15-year-old, just to have that discussion would be bad, you know.
I mean, just because it's not pedophilia
doesn't mean it's not wrong. But
it's also not bestiality. I mean, I don't understand.
Yeah, well, right. But people, they don't want to have discussions of any kind. Some people, and especially
not on Twitter, right?
You're right. It's Twitter is. But I think in person too, a lot of people are like that. Especially a lot of people we've had on the podcast. But Twitter makes it worse. Twitter makes it worse. I agree with you. To the anonymity of Twitter, when you're not in somebody's proximity, you know, it makes it worse. But anyway,
no, it's all more polarized than it's ever been. I mean, Al Tucher writes something, and people are emotional about that. And instead of sort of deconstructing the argument, Seinfeld was more attacking than sort of just offering a counter opinion.
Yeah, he did both. And he offered a counter opinion and then called him a putz.
Right, right.
In a rare Seinfeldian use of Yiddish, because Seinfeld has spent much of his career avoiding Yiddish. He's not exactly Jackie Mason. Seinfeld really never referred to Judaism in his stand-up act.
And you see that as Yiddish avoidance?
I think so. In the show Seinfeld...
I don't know if it's an active avoidance. I mean, maybe he didn't break into Yiddish.
I don't know if it was an active avoidance, but I think some people use Yiddish and some people don't. And he never did.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, he never did.
You know, I heard Billy Joel use Yiddish in an interview a few years ago, and I was kind of shocked. Because there's a guy who's been dancing around his own Judaism for decades. We all thought he was Italian. He would sing about his come out Virginia, the Catholic girls, and the Italian restaurant, Bottle of Red.
Well, but there are also, look, I don't know. I haven't followed any of those careers.
And Mama Leone moving out Antony's song. Antony, you know, remember Antony?
Right, but you don't know how he grew up, you know. It's like there are people that certainly where the way I grew up, like I identify with aspects of, you know, Lower East Side Jewy kind of hustle culture. But in terms of a more elevated, you know, lots of Yiddish references, like,
But I'm saying some people are more so whether it's avoidance or whether it's just he's not a Yiddish using person, I was kind of surprised to hear him call Al Tucher a putz for that reason. And I was also I heard Billy Joel referring to feeling I think nachas was the word that he used. He was describing his daughter's piano playing. He said this
right.
And I was like, nachas. Who are you? I mean, you've been because he Billy Joel was always very not Jew, you know, and you look, I get it, you're a rock star. There's nothing less rock and roll than Judaism, let's face it.
Well, but there are also different kinds of Jews. I mean, Israeli Jews tend to be, you know, it's more like, there's Jews like you, and then there's, I'm half Jewish, and I'm, you know. I mean,
Lenny Kravitz wears a big fucking diamond Jewish star around his
Lenny Kravitz will never use Yiddish.
Well, but the point being that a guy like Billy Joel, I mean, I think he had a little bit of a working class background on Long Island, right? I mean, it's not like we grew up on the Upper East Side right?
Well, Billy Joel is an interesting case. His grandfather was a very wealthy industrialist in Germany. I mean, millions of dollars, you know, and it was all taken by the Nazis. It was like Joel Industries or something. It was like textile. I don't know, whatever it was.
I didn't know that.
And then the Nazis took it. You know, they took Jewish businesses. So it was, the Joels were reduced to poverty, or at least to whatever they were reduced to. And they came to America. And I don't know what, his father, I think, ran out on the family and went back to Europe after the war or something like that. I don't know the history precisely, but yeah, he, you know, he was kind of a middle class guy, I guess. But his you know, his grandfather was a big industrialist.
And what sometimes later in life.
Pardon?
What or how have we veered into?
Yeah, I know we went into.
Well, Dom said that Billy Joel was middle class, and he is, but he's from fairly rarefied stock. His I believe his uncle was a big conductor. I know his brother's a conductor.
Yeah, he's got.
He's a conductor in Europe.
Talent. Yeah.
Should we try to have him on the show?
Huh?
Should we try to get him on the show?
Yeah, you can try. I mean, you could try. Yeah, because try. You know, God bless you. I mean,
all right, it's 8 o'clock.
Go ahead, try to swim the Atlantic Ocean. You go ahead. I mean, you know. I'm not stopping you. You know, you see how far you get.
I think I've achieved more difficult things than having.
No, you have.
I haven't.
Achieve more difficult things than getting Billy Joel on our podcast?
Yeah, who cares?
What have you done that is more difficult than that?
I mean, I've written 2 fucking books. I've had a baby.
Yes.
A lot of baby. You and 100 billion other women over the course of the, you know, over the course of human history. That have had a baby. I mean, and as far as writing 2 books, yes, that's an impressive achievement. Not as impressive as getting Billy Joel on the
podcast. I mean, I have to say that it would be really sad if that were my most impressive achievement.
Yeah, that would be very
Billy
sad.
Joel
yeah.
on this podcast.
Yeah. Well,
it would be, you know. It might not be your most profound.
Right, it would not be your most profound.
But it would be, it's something that's very difficult. It would be very difficult for me to juggle 10 balls.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's, that would be my most difficult achievement if I were able to. Does not mean that it is the most, with which I would be most proud or of which I would be most proud.
But that's a very interesting distinction because juggling 10 balls would be the most impressive thing anybody could possibly pull off. And yet it would be the least important thing they'd ever done. But the most impressive.
I mean, specifically Billy Joel or anybody sort of like Billy Joel?
Well, anybody at that level, you know. But, I mean, I don't want to disparage Dennis DeYoung because we did have him. He's wonderful.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But Billy Joel is, I mean, he's the piano man.
All right. It's 8:06.
Okay, so let's. We had a nice tight discussion today. So I want to thank Dove and Periel, and we'll get back to classic rock after this break. After this word from Town Tire.
And you can listen and also watch this episode on YouTube. And you can follow us at Live From The Table. Email us at.
Email us at podcast@comedyseller.com. And we'll leave you with Pizza Terra and Chicago if you leave me now. See you next time. Bye-bye.